Even in an era of citizen leaks, the Panama Papers stand out.
I mean, this was the biggest leak in history. It was terabytes of data.
This is Smari McCarthy, half Irish, half Icelandic, resident now in Bosnia, chairman of the European Pirate Party, more on that later, and chief technology officer for the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. That group, along with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists and a German paper called Süddeutsche Zeitung, processed the Panama Papers, 11.5 million documents handed over to the German newspaper by an anonymous whistleblower showing how the wealthy stashed their cash offshore. The impact has been seismic. Investigations, resignations, and reverberations around the world, and that's likely to continue for some time to come. This is Whose Century Is It? I'm Mary Kay Magstead. When Julian Assange and WikiLeaks kicked off the age of the digital leak, it seemed audacious. Then came Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden, criminals to some, heroes to others. Each has reminded us in different ways that we live in a century of technological promise and peril. Many of us live on our phones. That makes our life easier. It also makes it easier for our lives to be hacked by criminals and by the government. But it also makes it harder for people who are trying to hide something to hide it. And many of the world's wealthiest, not all, but a good number, aren't above shoveling their money into offshore accounts so they won't have to pay tax, or account for how they got all that money.
There is an estimate that about probably around $32 trillion are being hidden in offshore tax havens at the moment. We are now watching probably the largest transfer of wealth from developing countries to developed countries since the Spanish Armadas were moving around.
I caught up with Smari when he was visiting the Institute for the Future in Palo Alto, California, where I just became a fellow, an unpaid fellow, for this next year. IFTF, as it's called for short, is a not-for-profit think tank that does a version of what I'm doing, thinking about issues and trends and relationships likely to matter going forward. The difference is they have dozens of people who do 10-year forecasts professionally and thoroughly, while my conceit is to think, as a civilian and a journalist, with help from really smart people who know their fields of expertise, about the whole century. I don't even try to make forecasts. The variables are many. And it's the variables I think about in this podcast. In helping me do that, I'm looking forward to a year of exchanging ideas with the creative thinkers at IFTF and sharing some of those ideas with you. This episode comes at the question, whose century is it, by looking at power, traditional power, like wealth and political power, and the asymmetrical realigning power that has come from citizen leaks and large data dumps and is likely to play a bigger role in this century. So over to Smari, who I interviewed on a recent morning in IFTF's basement. If you hear scraping, there isn't much, but there is a little. It's the folks upstairs setting up chairs for his talk later that day.
So we're talking about the Panama Papers, and that was a big kind of global collaborative effort between about 400 different journalists working at 107 different news agencies.
How do 400 journalists in 107 news organizations in something like 80 different countries work together for a year in secret without anyone leaking?
Yeah, it's probably one of the largest and most successful conspiracies in recent history, a conspiracy to inform the public, right? And it was really funny. I went to the Global Investigative Journalism Conference in Lillehammer, Norway, last autumn. There were 900 people there, of which about a full third were involved in this project. So all of the conversations there had this kind of interesting vibe of people going, I'm working on something big, but I can't tell you about it.
and did people know who else was involved?
For many cases, but not all. So I couldn't tell you the names of more than maybe 10, 15 people who were directly involved. Not because it was secret. There were open communications. ICIJ has a kind of communication system internally, and they did a really good job of curating and getting all these people who have a professional interest in not telling anybody what they're working on to work together and pull in the same direction. So many people knew, but because I just do the technology stuff. I'm not a journalist.
That's a pretty important component.
Yeah, right. So I just kind of work with journalists and try to make sure that their needs are met.
What sorts of things were they coming to you with?
Near the end of the investigation, my primary role was making sure that everything was ready for publication. And it's the fate of every technologist to design websites now. That's just what life is. But there was also the component of our researchers maybe having a bunch of documents and wanting to know if there are any kind of connections between people in them, or trying to find an efficient way of pulling out a set of names or something like that, which it turns out there are types of problems that computers are really good at that humans are really bad at, and types of problems that humans are really good at and computers are really bad at.
For instance?
Well, pulling a lot of similar data out of similarly structured documents and putting them into a list is something that humans would take a long time to do and computers can do in a matter of seconds. Unfortunately, a lot of humans still try to do it the traditional way and also end up injecting a lot of errors just by being hasty and so on. So if you've got 20,000 documents and they all have exactly the same formatting and you just want to, you know, copy a number out of each one, right? Having an intern do it is a terrible waste of the intern's time, right? But having a techie sit down and write a little script, it might take an hour or two or maybe less, you know, depending on the techie. But you're going to get the results within seconds once it's done, right?
Right.
On the other hand, there are types of problems that computers are still really, really bad at, such as pulling the same numbers out of 20,000 documents which are all different, and where the number might be, or the name, or whatever it is in some kind of context grammatically that, you know, where it might change and shift. Where essentially our ability to understand human grammar in computer terms, or the ability for computers to understand human grammar, is somewhat limited still. But we're getting better at that in the computer side.
So from your perspective, what did you see as the most challenging aspects of this project?
It is a relatively small group of people who are controlling the vast majority of wealth in the world. So looking at something like the Panama Papers, you come at it with, like, okay, here's a really large set of documents, 11 million documents, and in there are many of the paths that explain where all this money went. Now, Mossack Fonseca is only one of, you know, hundreds or thousands of law firms that do this kind of service. And you're not going to find all of the mega rich people working through the same companies. In fact, they're probably diversifying, doing things through multiple companies, because that's what you do if you're being sensible about this kind of thing. But on the other hand, you know, that leak has probably information about tens or hundreds of billions of dollars worth of assets that are being hidden. So far in Iceland alone, there are over 180 different cases been opened by the tax authorities after the Panama Papers leaks to investigate people in Iceland who seem to have been doing things in a slightly different way than the tax authorities would have liked. On the other hand, you're looking at this, you know, 11 million documents, and you say, okay, how do we go from this set of emails and all sorts of PDF documents and all sorts of things like that to results? And it's just not intuitive. The journalists say they just have the tradition of sitting down and just reading everything and trying to memorize it all until they see a pattern in their mind, and then they go, aha, we just nailed this guy, you know. As a technologist, my approach is, can we write a short little program that'll read through all the documents and figure it out? For certain types of things, yes, but for other types of things, no.
Were you expecting the kind of impact that the papers have had? Were you expecting more?
I don't know. I think probably the length of the project led to being somewhat relaxed about it. And it was funny when we released it. So we kind of expected a lot more traffic on our website than we normally got. And so we kind of beefed up our servers a little bit. And we thought, okay, we're going to get probably 8 times more, maybe 10 times more traffic than usual. So we prepared for that and we did some simulations and things like that. And then we got something like, I'm going to say 50 times more traffic. And so there was a moment where we're just going like, oh no, everything is going to collapse. And it didn't. It worked out fine. But, you know, the immediate impact was gargantuan.
So in your own biography online, you say that you live at the intersection between politics and technology. And you've been very busy this past decade. You've co-founded MailPile. You've been involved in the Icelandic Pirate Party. You founded that, or co-founded it.
Yeah, one of the founders, yeah.
Yeah, and now the European Pirate Party.
Yeah, I kind of ended up chairman of that, mostly by accident. I was asked whether I would be willing to be on the board, and I said yes, and then I couldn't make it to the meeting, so I got shanghaied into that kind of situation. Very pirate-like, I guess.
So the Pirate Party concept has been around for about a decade, started in Sweden, but I think a lot of people don't really know what it is and kind of chuckle when they even hear the term Pirate Party.
Yeah, the name is a bit silly and very intentionally so. There were some Hollywood lobbyists who decided that copyright infringement in Sweden was a big problem, so they set up a thing in Sweden called the Anti-Piracy Bureau, and some people there thought, well, that's really interesting. Like, they're having this very one-sided conversation with stakeholders and government about downloading things on the internet, and we have this other approach. So they went and founded a thing called the Pirate Bureau, so just kind of as a counterpoint to the Hollywood lobbyists. And that kind of mushroomed first into the Pirate Bay, and then later people started thinking about a political party around it to try and approach the political side of the debate a bit more directly and possibly with a little bit more seriousness.
There's a very piratey kind of vibe to this whole project. You know, you're attacking the rich and the powerful, not taking their money, but taking their privacy, taking what they're trying to hide, and trying to sort of change the equation, change the power equation.
I don't think we're taking their privacy, because privacy is a very specific thing, and privacy is my right to choose in which way I expose myself to society. But my financial dealings are actually part of a conversation that each person has with society. The existence of a company or a corporation is a contract with the rest of society that they're going to allow you to do certain things as long as you comply with certain rules. So what we're doing in this case is not taking away people's individual privacy. I don't know what Vladimir Putin gets up to in his free time. I don't know what Ilham Aliyev gets up to in his free time, nor do I want to. It's just none of my business. But when they are doing things through proxies, through their family members, etc., that are in violation of the kind of social contract, even though I kind of dislike that term, it's been watered down too much, and they do so in ways that lead to massive theft from the public, that lead to dodging taxes and doing all sorts of things that are just bad for society, that's not their private business, and everybody should know about it. I'm fine with exposing that.
It's a very refreshing point of view, particularly after the last election, where there was this pushback against President Obama having said, you know, if you have a company and, you know, you're saying that you have a right to run it however you want to and profit from it, you know, you didn't build that on your own. You built that within a society. Yeah. And then the Republicans pushed back and said, I built that. It's mine. And, you know, I have the right to do with it what I want. And now you have Trump saying, I don't need to release my tax returns. Yeah. You don't have a right to see that information.
Yeah, and I'm not. I think in tax returns, you sometimes have things like your address, you know, your closest family members listed, things like that, that totally are private. But your financial transactions as a person, and in particular, your communication with the tax authorities, how is a government supposed to be open and transparent and accountable to the electorate and to the public if the most important part of how that same government collects money to fund its operations is completely intransparent and there's no way to see what's going on? It's ridiculous. In the same way as if the budget were secret, everybody would say, no, that's not okay. So, you know, there have been these kind of waves of discussion in transparency circles, starting with the Freedom of Information Act in the US, so it's 1970 in different countries. Sweden actually was first back in the 1700s. They started to move in that direction. And nowadays, most Western countries and most countries in the world, in fact, have Freedom of Information Acts of one form or another. But that's kind of moved along, in that initially, like, the first generation of such laws said, you are allowed to request any kind of document you want. But you need to know what kind of document it is, and you need to ask very specifically for that document and not too many. The second generation said, okay, you can ask for any document, and here is a list of the documents that we hold. And that changes the game quite a bit, because it allows people to know what they want.
Right? To say, wait, what's that? That looks interesting. Yeah. Let me take a look at that.
And then you've got the third generation, which is saying, okay, we're going to not only provide you with the list, but we're going to put the list on the internet, and you can click the names and just download the document by default. And if the document is secret for national security reasons or for privacy reasons, you know, whatever reasons there are, then it's not available and you can ask for it. And then a future improvement on that would be, if a document is held back, it says why it's held back and who authorized it and when that authorization is rescinded. A similar thing is happening with budgets. In some countries, parts of the budget are secret. In Morocco, for instance, I had this really fun time in Morocco once when me and some Moroccan activists were going around trying to figure out if we could find the parts of the country's budget that is secret that pertains to the king and his many, many, many palaces. We didn't succeed, but it was an interesting experiment. But that's a place where, you know, taxes are coming in. Taxes are going out in the form of budgetary allocations, but then there's this big black box of stuff that's happening and nobody's allowed to know exactly what. And black budgets are bad, pretty much, because, you know, you can't run a democracy if people don't know what's going on.
Yeah. So you've had a commitment since your college days, right,
yeah,
to transparency, accountability, distributed democracy. Where did that come from? Did you just grow up thinking these are important values for me?
Yeah, I'd say I'm very much a kind of child of the internet. Growing up on a very small island off the south coast of Iceland with 4,000 people and 10 million birds, and I found it very difficult in my teens to kind of relate to people there. There were only a few people who I could kind of fit in with, but I found these online communities when I got this, you know, little modem when I was about 13, and, you know, connected to the internet, and there were all these communities, and everybody was kind of talking about all sorts of things, and I'm like, this is the best thing ever. But then as I got more into it, I started learning about all of these problems that existed around the internet, with people wanting to do censorship, people wanting to limit which groups were allowed to participate. There were people being arrested for all sorts of things, such as, you know, everything from reading manuals they weren't supposed to read to sharing documents that they weren't supposed to share. And I kind of fell into this kind of political world entirely by accident. I had never really intended to get political. But when things started to move in that direction, in Iceland in particular, there was at one point a levy that was placed on empty CDs. And that was one of the first times I attended a protest. It was like, okay, they want to put an extra surcharge on all empty CDs that were writable that would go to the music industry. But I was thinking at the time, well, I don't use CDs to write music. I use CDs to
back up your documents.
Back up my documents, to share copies of Linux, a free open source operating system with people, you know, that kind of thing. And I'm like, why should we be paying the music industry for that? From there, it kind of just steamrolled. You know, transparency is an obvious extension of the mindset of the internet and on all of these other topics, right?
Yeah. So by the time WikiLeaks came around,
yeah,
what kind of impact did that have on you? Were you already thoroughly engaged in this set of issues?
Yeah. So me and a few friends had started a thing that we called the Icelandic Digital Freedom Society a few years earlier, and we'd mostly been using it to occasionally talk to the government about different topics like Creative Commons and free software in schools and things like that. And we also organized a annual conference. And in 2009, when WikiLeaks released Kaupthing's large loan book, it was essentially a set of slides from one of the Icelandic banks that had collapsed in the collapse.
The great financial crisis of 2008 and onward, yeah.
Exactly. And so they leaked this set of slides which showed all of these uncollateralized loans that the bank had been giving out to essentially friends of the owners, you know, completely uncollateralized, really large denomination loans. And this kind of sent shockwaves through Icelandic society. So we figured, okay, we're doing this conference again. We need some keynote speakers. Why don't we invite WikiLeaks over to do the keynote? And while they were in Iceland, we I ended up, and some of my other friends ended up both helping WikiLeaks with a couple of releases, but also opening up this kind of broader conversation about how do we start changing laws in useful ways to protect free speech and access to information and increase transparency and protect whistleblowers and all of these different things, essentially what one could call information politics. Like, how does one progress that to a higher point than it was at the time? Out of that came the IMMI project, which is now the International Modern Media Institute. And also, I ended up working with WikiLeaks on the collateral murder video, so the video of an Apache helicopter attack in New Baghdad, and also the Afghan war logs and onwards for a few months.
And how receptive was the population in Iceland to some of these ideas, to the work you were doing?
So it never really got a whole lot of media attention in Iceland, which was really weird because all of the other world media kind of latched onto this very, very quickly. And I guess it was a good lesson in the cynicism of Icelandic journalists that if they hear something's happening in Iceland, they probably go like, that's probably just a waste of time, somebody being loud about something. Whereas all of the other world media kind of jumped onto it, both out of kind of interest. Okay, there's something quirky happening in this little country up there, might be fun to cover, but also, we really wish we could get that kind of thing in our country. So over many weeks, we were, I was doing, 7-8 interviews a day. It was pretty mad. At the same time, nobody in Iceland really cared at all.
So you continue working on issues of transparency and accountability and distributed democracy. And you see, as time goes on, Edward Snowden.
Yes.
Coming out with all the information that he released in coordination and cooperation with specific news media. Did it surprise you the kind of reaction that came from the Obama administration in particular?
Yeah, I like many others in the world, was very excited when President Obama won that election back in his first term. And we thought, finally the United States is going to catch up with the rest of the world in terms of basic kind of liberal agenda. And then, both the drone striking, and then there's also how more people have been prosecuted under the Obama administration, who early on had been very open to there being whistleblowers and informing about wrongdoing in the government. Once people started to inform about wrongdoing in the government, then people started being prosecuted, and it was pretty ridiculous. You have Chelsea Manning, who was the only person so far who's been convicted of anything after she exposed literally thousands of war crimes that had gone undocumented, right? And then Edward Snowden comes along and shows the world that not only the United States, but also its Five Eyes partners are engaged in a global, essentially, conspiracy to monitor the communications of everybody. And they're doing so at a rough budget of $120 billion a year, which means that they're monitoring roughly everybody who has any kind of electronic communications capacity. So it's about 3.5 billion people, which means they're spending about 7 cents per person per day to monitor everybody, right? First off, it's kind of remarkable how cheap they managed to get it, but also just that they managed to violate all the human rights that people fought for through World War One and Two. The amount of suffering that humanity had to go through to arrive at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is huge. And that entire thing should be essentially trashed on a whim by governments who claim national security interests that have been so far entirely unproven. There have been very few, if any, court cases over terrorists. I mean, there's this entire thing, right?
Where do you think it went wrong in terms of, sort of a diversion between what stated principles are in terms of human rights and respect for individual dignity and so forth, and what the U.S. is actually doing in the world?
Yeah, that's a hard question because, I mean, there are kind of simplistic answers that you can give, but if you look at the entire history of any country, there's going to be ups and downs, and It's easy to go back to issues of slavery and ethnic cleansing and in the early days of the US and stuff like that and say, well, it's kind of always been kind of bad. But that would be somewhat unfair as well. I think more recently the thing that has been particularly problematic in this country has been the way in which politics and the military-industrial complex and large corporations in general are interacting through things like campaign financing, through things like the revolving door and that kind of thing. Really, everything that Eisenhower predicted has come true, but there's an entire technological aspect to it that he didn't really predict, where you have mass surveillance and essentially unlimited processing capacity. So if the US really wants to get back on the track to being a global center for, you know, respect of human rights and human dignity, shutting that down to some extent, or, you know, at least reducing it, would be one of the obvious steps.
So as there are interventions like the Panama Papers and like Edward Snowden's efforts and WikiLeaks, are you seeing the kinds of changes that redistribute power, that allow citizens to have more of a say, to try to pull institutions back to their original purpose if they have sort of gone off the rails? Or are you feeling like it's really not having the kind of impact you'd like to see?
It's been a little bit frustrating over the last, say, 5 years to see how much growth there has been in far-right extremism, in particular in Europe, where you have, say, Viktor Orban's government in Hungary putting out a new media law that allows a kind of media committee to decide to levy fines against media that are being unfair by some arbitrary definition, right? Which has a massive chilling effect on media in Hungary. And under the cloth of that, they changed the constitution and redefined the Hungarian state in ways that are very useful for far-right extremist tendencies. You can see the same thing happening now in Poland under Beata Szydlo's government, where they did essentially exactly the same thing. And you've got, you know, people being sued in Luxembourg for having leaked documents and so on. So in many ways, I think the public have been very usefully enlightened by all of these leaks. And we're in a much better position in terms of public knowledge than often before. But I also think that people are becoming very afraid of their neighbors, becoming very just afraid of everything. And
is it afraid of their neighbors or afraid of immigrants?
Well,
afraid
both.
Of sort of the other people they don't know well.
Well, the kind of philosophical other, most definitely. And this is feared that a lot of politicians, are, in particular on the far right, are benefiting massively from. There's a feeling that a lot of people have, and possibly to some degree amplified by all of these disclosures and this understanding that everything is a little bit off, plus the financial crisis and so on, that everybody sees that there's a problem in the world. And they're not entirely sure what the cause of the problem is necessarily. But they think, okay, there's a problem. And here are all these traditional politicians who are saying, oh, no, there's no problem. We'll deal with this. It's all fine. Everything's fine. And then, you know, some crazy nut job shows up, and, you know, let's just call him Donald Trump or something like that, and he says, no, everything is a mess, everything is totally messed up, but don't worry, I'll take care of it, and I'll tell you what's wrong. It's the immigrants, and it's the such and such a small minority which cannot defend itself from the things that I'm going to be saying. And, you know, you've got in Germany even now a essentially Nazi party has been doing really well in state elections. They got, I think, 20% in state elections in some of the German states. So this is really worrying to me.
Yeah. Although, I mean, ironically, if you look in the broad sweep of history, where we're at today globally is probably, you know, there are probably fewer wars. There are probably fewer people who are dying of hunger and of other avoidable causes than at any point in human history. Living longer, you know, we have a clear and present danger in the form of climate change.
Yes.
And that is accelerating immigration to places where people can actually make a living.
Yeah.
And at the same time, there's a concentration of wealth in fewer and fewer hands, which is what the Panama Papers got at. And it seems like those things, you
and
know,
it all interacts. It all plays together.
Yeah.
And One of the ways that we see this play out, and you're right, there's been a incredible decline in deaths due to war and disease just over the last 100, 200 years. And now there's never been fewer people dying from war. But in history, we've seen on multiple occasions this kind of pattern where first you have a financial collapse, then you have a massive rise in nationalism, and then you have a war. And we are at step two of that right now. And I don't want to see what step three looks like. So we need somehow to back down from this nationalistic rhetoric and start to actually address the problems properly, which are, yes, climate change issues and wealth inequality. Those are kind of the big issues that need to be dealt with right now. With those $32 trillion that are sitting in offshore accounts, we could completely fix every healthcare system on the planet. We could probably eradicate two or three different diseases within this decade. It would be possible to eliminate so many of the social problems that we have. And moreover, a lot of the financial crisis comes from that much money being kind of piled up in one place. So, you know, letting it out into the system in a kind of calm and manageable way would probably help a lot of societies.
Seems a pretty good place to end. Smari McCarthy, thanks for joining me on Whose Century Is It? I appreciate Smari's idealism and focus on a possible future that is fairer and more equitable. I agree that the current degree of wealth disparity is dangerous and unsustainable. But how do you get from having $32 trillion, give or take, in offshore accounts to distributing that money in social programs around the world? In an ideal world, it would be repatriated to the appropriate countries, taxed, and responsible governments would use it with the best interests of all citizens in mind. And if you live in Northern Europe, you could actually see that kind of thing happening. In the United States, where Congress of late has been more interested in cutting spending on social programs, harder. In kleptocracies like Azerbaijan, harder still. One step toward getting there is to make it harder for people to hide money. That's what the release of the Panama Papers did. Thanks to Smari McCarthy, Chief Technology Officer for the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. You can learn more about him and his organization and the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists on our website, pri.org/century. You'll also find a transcript of this interview and all of this podcast's past episodes. This is episode 20, so there's a lot to choose from, including a practitioner's guide to seeing into the future, a look at how to protect internet rights in an age of surveillance, and two recent episodes on whether there's authoritarian creep in the United States and beyond. Check them out. You can also find them on SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes, and most other podcast apps. And if you haven't yet subscribed, please do. If you like Whose Century Is It, give us 5 stars. It helps others find the podcast. Suggestions, comments, criticisms, send me a note on Twitter. I'm at Mary Kay Magstad, that's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. Whose Century Is It is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC World Service and WGBH. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. I'll be back in a couple of weeks with a new episode. Hope you'll join me then.